Everybody, the House State Affairs Committee will please come to order, and would you please call the roll?
Representative P. Wilson.
Here.
Representative Seaton.
Here.
Representative Keller, not present.
Representative Keller is excused.
Representative Grunberg.
Here.
Representative Peterson.
Here.
Representative Johansson.
Present.
Chair Lynn.
I am here. I don't care what they all say. I'm here. This morning on our calendar, we have, in this order, we're going to hear these bills. We're going to hear HB 180, having to do with veterans designation on driver's licenses. Next, we're going to hear HB 178 on election procedures. And thirdly, we're going to hear HB 190 on PFD allowable absences military, depending upon the time schedule and how it goes here. So with that, let's please go to HB 180, and we have, looks like I have a sponsor of the bill here, and please put yourself on the record and tell us all about this bill.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dan Sadler, representative for House District 18, and I'm here to represent and ask your support for House Bill 180. House Bill 180 is a simple bill, as we said. It authorizes the Division of Motor Vehicles to note a person's status as a veteran on their state driver's license or identification card. It also authorizes DMV to give the name and address of a person who receives that veteran's designation to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. House Bill 180 seeks to help Alaska veterans who have retired or were discharged under honorable conditions to receive more of the benefits which they have earned through their sacrifice and their service in uniform, and to which they are entitled by law and by custom. Alaska is one of our most veteran-friendly states. About 60% of businesses show their appreciation to veterans by offering various discounts, preferences, and other benefits. By giving Alaskans a way to carry reliable, convenient, and durable proof of their veteran status on state-issued cards, this measure will help veterans more easily enjoy the full range of personal, social, and business benefits offered to them without having to carry hard copies of their DD-214, DD-215, or NGB-22 discharge forms to prove their veteran status. There's another more important aspect of HB 180. It authorizes DMV to provide the names and addresses of veterans who obtained this designation to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Tens of thousands of Alaska veterans currently have no contact with the state's Office of Veterans Affairs, and they could be missing out on significant government benefits. Passage of this bill will make it easier for the state to reach out to these veterans and make them aware of the programs available to them and help them receive the benefits owed. I would respectfully request your support for House Bill 180 and be glad to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the committee. Any questions on this bill? Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had similar legislation in front of the committee. I just noticed as a little bit of an anomaly in a prior committee, the majority leader put a do not pass. I'm wondering if you could, if you were at the committee hearing, could you articulate maybe some of his concerns? I haven't had time to read the minutes, and I apologize for that.
Would you tell me when that was?
It was on March 18th. And the bill passed out of Military Veterans Affairs, and it just seems odd. I rarely see a do not pass on bills like this. Wondering if there was a specific concern that the majority leader had with the bill.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Representative Johansson, I obviously noticed that as well. I'm not sure the reason why, but there was discussion in Military and Veterans Affairs about the fiscal note and the hours of programming work that were going to be involved. You'd have to ask Representative Osterman, but there may have been some concern about that. It's been adjusted in the replacement fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Continue, please.
Thank you. So there was no specific issue that was raised in Military Veterans Affairs that led you to believe from the majority leader that there was a specific problem? Is that correct?
Through the chair, no.
Thank you.
And I was on the same committee. I didn't, nor did I hear any specific objections from anybody. Any follow-up? Was that Representative Wilson? Did you have your hand up?
Yes.
Representative Wilson, thank you.
Thank
Good
you,
morning.
Mr. Chairman. I'm torn a little bit, and I'll explain why. First of all, I think, well, we're going to do some of this so that we can help more people find more free things. You know, more, you know. But having said that, I can remember when my brother was sick. He'd been in Vietnam. When he was sick and he didn't have any health insurance. And he just didn't realize that he could have went and got some help from the Veterans Administration. And because he didn't have any health insurance, he waited a long time before he went. And when he went to the, finally went to the doctor, he had cancer, and he died at the age of 52. And I think if he would have thought he had realized he had insurance, he probably would have went earlier, and they might have been able to do something. So because of that, you know, like I say, I'm torn, but I think there's a lot of veterans that don't feel like, well, I'm fine, I don't need anything, and they don't realize the benefits that they have. And so because of that, I think this is really, in the long run, a good bill. And I like it, and even though I'm torn one way or in the other, I think it'll be good for our veterans.
Thank you very much. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And generally, the programs that are offered by businesses, are those offered for active military as well as veterans?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe that most of them are offered to veterans. Active duty military members do have a Department of Defense issued identification card. And I suppose if a business wanted to offer a benefit or a discount or some kind of special deal to a serving member, I think there are some programs that do offer a military discount. I didn't do research. We couldn't do research on active duty military, but we do know that about 60% of businesses, regional, national chains, do offer that kind of discount. And many independent businesses in Alaska, because we have such an important military presence, also offer those discounts. We couldn't find a hard number. We talked to the Armed Forces, YMCA, Chambers of Commerce, other local business organizations, and that's the best number we can come up with.
Okay. Follow up. But for those active military, they would have a active military ID so that they would be able to access that.
Those, sure. Yes, sir.
Through that mechanism, they wouldn't need their driver's license or need the indication on the driver's license.
That's correct, no.
Thank you.
I just showed him my military ID card, which I'm very proud of. Representative Peterson and then Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sadler, I was just wondering, now the DMV is not going to charge the veterans an additional fee to get this mark on their on their driver's license. Is that correct?
That's correct. Through the chair, Representative Peterson, that's correct. We wanted to make sure that to point out that there is no additional fee for the veteran's designation on driver's license. However, the same standard $15 for the DMV charges for replacement card will be charged.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions, and some of them I think I'll better ask to the DMV representative. My first question is on Section 1 through the Chair, Representative Sadler. Mm-hmm. This, and I'm just searching through this, I believe this amends the sections on identification cards. Why don't we have this, or do we have this already for driver's licenses? Because those are different statutes.
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, my understanding through drafting is the original bill did just go for driver's licenses. And we came back and there's an earlier version of the bill that just had driver's licenses. We did get a replacement CS, and it was adopted by MLV, that also added state ID cards.
Mr. Chair, oh, I see. Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay, that's
right.
My first question. Secondly, and maybe I should ask this to the DMV representative, but not now.
Okay.
That's going to be through the chair. You've added the word solely on line 10 and also on line 5. Should I ask them why you added the word solely, or do you want to answer that?
I would like to, Representative Grimmer, through the chair. The reason for the solely is we wanted to make it pointed. We wanted to avoid confusion. I think people's expectation could be that, oh, it's going to be a free driver's license for veterans. That is not the case. It's just a little extra fill-up of language solely for that designation.
Okay, that makes
sense. At one point, we even considered saying, but they would still have to pay for the regular replacement driver's license, but Ledge Legal came back and said that's probably not necessary given the language.
And third, if I may, through the chair, follow up.
Third strike.
These questions, these last two lines of questions relate to the privacy aspect. Suppose for some reason, and I don't know why, but the person doesn't want to have the information forwarded to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Maybe they, as a veteran myself, some veterans may be in eccentric or just have a desire for privacy and not want to have this information. It may not want to be in the database, in other words. And I'm wondering if there should be something possibly on line 13, for example, to say unless the veteran objects. Because I could see potentially a veteran objecting. And I'm a member of some veterans organizations, and some of them have their own reasons, and I don't know. But
and we're going to be hearing, we have some veterans organization representatives who are going to be testifying in just a few minutes.
I was just wondering.
Any questions? Through the chair, Representative Grimmie, that's a fair question. I think our intent was to make it very clean. It should be pretty apparent to a veteran applying that if he applies for this veteran's designation, ID, or driver's license, his name and address will be provided too. He's certainly under no, he or she, pardon me, is under no obligation to engage in conversation with the Office of Veterans Affairs beyond that initial contact, but to go an extra step towards respecting the privacy concerns potentially of a veteran, I would not be averse to seeing an amendment to that. I hadn't thought of that. That's considered.
Through the chair, we'll explore that. And finally, and I'm following up kind of that thinking, and it's not the kind of thinking I would have, but somebody might. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of letting the folks online know I'm going to ask them that too. If this information is forwarded to the department, mm-hmm. will that be public information? Or is there any, somebody else is shaking their head, I guess. Okay. Okay, we'll ask somebody else. Thank you. Thank you for letting me explore that.
Thank you. And I believe Representative Wilson is next.
I just want to pursue, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to pursue what you just said. I cannot think, first of all, that designation isn't going to appear on the driver's license unless they request it and show proof that they're a veteran. And if they want to keep it quiet, I don't think that veteran is going to do that.
I don't know. I wouldn't.
I would agree.
But I don't know what they're going to say.
Yeah. So, I personally don't think an amendment would be in order, because if a person wants to keep, for whatever reason, not mention it, then he or she wouldn't even ask for it to appear on their driver's license.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? At this moment from the committee, Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed the fiscal note was created about 6 days after it passed out of Military Veterans Affairs, if I'm reading this correctly, obviously because it was a CS. So I'm assuming there was no fiscal note with the initial bill as it had a finance picked up, or can you just walk me through, because I have a question on the fiscal note and I want to understand the trail first.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Johansson. Actually, we did have a fiscal note, which is in my book under original fiscal note. It's the version A dated the 11th of March. And we did have that with us when we had the first hearing. So the follow-up, the new fiscal note was in response to some of the questions asked during that committee meeting. We had some questions about the amount of time for programming, and so resulted in the updated and scaled down revenue and cost. So certainly entertain questions on the updated fiscal note.
If I may continue. Thank you. I don't have the original fiscal note in my packet, so I can't compare.
I'm
but
sorry.
Can you, I have had issues with DMV because, frankly, they're a moneymaker for the state. And I see here that basically a veteran would come in and say, I want a new license with the designation on it, and they will be charged a fee, and that's reflected in the fiscal note. Do you have you had discussions about having this renewal paid for by DMV, not charged for the whole process of getting the new license? Because it looks to me like the cost is, the money they're making off of this far exceeds the cost as usual at DMV. And do you have any sort of an issue with that, or are you going to get on finance in 2 years and fix that for me? Or
Representative Hansen, through the chair, from your mouth to God's ears. to answer the question directly, we did not entertain the option of making this a free and clear gift in all regards to veterans. They're citizens as well. There is a charge to the state for issuing the replacement driver's license, and so we just figured that would be the best way to go. If you have specific questions about the fiscal note and the reasons for the charges, we do have the director of DMV online to answer those questions.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
I would encourage you as the sponsor, when it gets to the Finance Committee, to consider maybe not free, maybe at cost might be a better way to do it. I'd like to give it away free to the veterans, but I don't necessarily want DMV to be making money off of this exchange, and maybe an idea of just doing it at cost might make me feel better about the bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson, and then Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a not a new driver's license, but a identification card so that I could carry it with me when I travel and I wouldn't have to worry about losing my driver's license. So I carry that, and it costs $15. And the veterans can either wait until it's time to renew their driver's license, but anything that the DMV makes, they don't keep it. It goes into the general fund. And then their budget goes through the process just like every other department budget does. In other words, we go through and look at it as legislators and decide how the budget's going to be and whether we're going to take something out or whatever. But they do make way over more than what it costs them. However, that does go into the general fund. So,
thank you. Okay, Representative Peterson, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking at the explanation of the fiscal note, and they're assuming that 50% of these veterans are going to choose to get this designation within the first 12 months. That, to me, seems like a kind of a reach. I don't know. Maybe the sponsor has got an opinion on that.
And through the chair, Representative Peterson, I would defer that question to the director of DMV, who we've got available to us.
Okay. And she'll be online.
Okay.
Just a few minutes. Any other questions at this point? Perhaps we should go to the DMV director first, and then go to the other folks from some of the veterans organizations who would like to make comments. Representative Grunberg.
It's just one question, and this goes to the number two on the fiscal note, the 75% to 50%. I know that a lot of veterans are kind of, well, not a lot, but some are on the fringes. And the only time they get really involved, some of them, is when they have stand-downs and stuff like that. Is it your anticipation that there will be any educational efforts to the veteran community to let them know about this?
The chair for making a very good question, so I appreciate that. The legislation does not make provision for a public outreach or educational effort, but I suspect that as we have the director of the Office of Veterans Affairs online, he strongly suspect and will confirm that with him in questioning, that he will make that information available to veterans as he comes in contact with them. There are documents in his possession that show the full range of veterans' benefits available, and I suspect this will be added to that list.
And I would imagine, too, that some of these good veterans organizations would also have some kind of outreach.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to, looks like, Carrie Hennings, please, from DMV. Are you online?
Mr. Chairman, actually, Ms. Hennings is not on the line. This is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that there has been a lot of conversation regarding the fiscal note associated with this bill, and there was a lot of debate in the prior committee regarding the fiscal note, and we provided updated information to address some of the questions that came up. Through the chair, specifically Representative Peterson, regarding the percentage of those who would of those veterans who would opt for the designation on the license. This percentage is based just basically on conversation that the DMV has had with the different veterans. This is anecdotal. If the committee believes that this is too high, we can certainly adjust that. I am not a veteran. My father is a veteran, and there are others at the DMV who are veterans who have stated that if there is a benefit to having that designation on the license or on the ID card, that they would certainly go about getting that designation placed on there. But again, if the committee believes that that percentage is too high based on your experiences, we can certainly adjust that. I appreciate Representative Wilson's comments about the DMV not keeping the fees that it brings in. The DMV does go through the budgetary process just like every other agency, and the fees that we collect go directly to the general fund. So if it is the will of the legislature that we not collect those fees for veterans, we could certainly do that. It would not have a significant impact on the DMV. With that, I'd be happy to entertain any other questions that the committee has.
Any questions? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, how did you pick the date of March 1? Was that just a kind of adjusted for fiscal purposes or what?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the effective date of the bill is March 1st, and so that is the date we used in the fiscal note.
My question was, why did you select that date?
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the effective date that date was chosen by the sponsor and was at the request of the Division of Motor Vehicles because we have a number of federal requirements that our IT section is working on regarding commercial driver licensing that needs to be done by January of 2012. And the sponsor was very kind to allow the effective date to be slightly after as this will require IT involvement.
May I follow up, please?
And IP means what?
IT.
I'm sorry, IT. Information technology.
Thank you.
Our programming and computer folks.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Brewster, if this information goes, I'm going to ask you a different question. What type of educational efforts are you going to make, not just through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, but through the Division of Motor Vehicles? What educational to inform potential people who come to renew driver's license, get identification cards, how are you going to inform them of this availability?
Representative Grunberg, I imagine the DMV would issue media releases as well as put information on the DMV's website, as well as have information in the DMV offices regarding the new designation. If there is further outreach, I would depend on the experts in this field as far as dealing with the veteran community. If there is anything further that would be needed or desired by the legislature, I am certainly happy to entertain those ideas.
I would assume that somebody comes in to get a driver's license, that somebody might say, do you wish to have a veteran designation on your driver's license, and if so, here's what you need.
Through the chair. This may be an opportunity.
Would you please give her a chance to answer?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Ms. Brewster?
Mr. Chairman, we could certainly do that. But by and large, the population that the DMV sees is just folks of every background coming into the DMV. We do ask specifically if the customer wishes to be an organ donor and wishes to donate a dollar to that program. But if it is the wish of the legislature for us to ask the question of every customer that comes in the door, we could do that, yes.
And that could be done through regulation, right? We don't need that statute, I wouldn't think. Or through office policy.
Mr. Chairman, it would not require a statutory change to ask that question.
Yeah, ergo, it wouldn't require an amendment. Representative Grunberg.
I was to follow up on that. A lot of people now do their business with the DMV through the mail and through internet, and they would never know about this. I'm concerned about what Representative Wilson said a minute ago about her brother, and I know that my shipmates and some of those people, well, they're involved because they're in veterans group, but the most of the people who are on my ship don't know anything about the Whitfield County Veterans Association, but they all drive. And what I'm wondering is, this is sufficiently important, and the Vietnam vets are graying now, and they need these services. And this is a way. You're already gray.
I'm already gray. Okay.
That was to the chair.
Okay.
So am I, actually. This may be an opportunity, a unique opportunity, to notify a group of people about services. And I'm wondering, is there something that we can do to ensure that when people have their vehicle licenses renewed, when they have their driver's licenses renewed, this is a great opportunity to give them this information, and that way they'll get plugged in and they'll learn about their benefits. Ms. Brewster, can you do that? Would that cost any money? Would it be something that would require legislation here? This is a really good opportunity.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I definitely agree with what you are saying, and the DMV could look at all of its forms and all of its mail outs, as well as different information that is posted on the DMV's website, to get the word out. When it comes to vehicle registration, we could likely insert a flyer that highlights the new program and the designation. I certainly agree that this is a good opportunity to get the word out, and we could do that, and that would not require a statute change, and it would not, it could be done with minimal to no cost.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Grunberg, I applaud your efforts to try and make sure this. It's the second half of this bill, which I really appreciate you bringing to the floor. I use an awful lot of online banking and applications and so forth myself. Very often I will tab through a field that does not apply to me, the questions on this, that, either race, residence, veteran status, and so forth. So I strongly suspect that it'd be really easy to tab through that and make the question available, and people could answer or not. And I would offer one gentle correction. I suspect that the sailors of the Whitfield County don't all drive, they all steam.
they all what?
They all steam.
All steam.
We'll see that.
All right. Representative Seaton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And, not talking about a transitional time, but with Ms. Whitney, I think that this is going to be a box to check on the application, where it says, are you a veteran and do you wish to have a veteran designation on your license? So other than this transitional time, is it anticipated that there will be such a notice on the application for a driver's license?
Ms. Brewster?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that is what I imagine will occur. We would have the form modified to have a checkbox for the veteran's designation, and that's how we would then, trigger the clerk to enter that information into the system for that designation.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the line of questioning that the Representative Grunberg is asking, it might be helpful to ask the directors of the Veterans Office what kinds of educational outreach efforts Verdi Bowen might be able to put on the table for people as well to meet that goal.
Okay. Let me, so I don't keep...
Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Yeah. We're going to go to the Veterans Organization first because these people are... You're not on the clock, it's their own time. Okay. And people from the DMV and, of course, the Veterans Affairs, you know, they're, this is their work.
Yep.
So if we can we go to Ron Siebold? You were the regional commander of military, Order of the Military Purple Heart. Are you online, sir?
Yes, sir, I am here.
Yeah, thank you for your service. Would you please identify yourself?
Yes, I'd just like to echo the supportive comments made by the committee members. I think this is going to produce some positive results in the lives of Alaska veterans. I'm in full support of this, and I hope everyone there on your committee supports it, moves it forward. For the educational aspect, I'm sure Verdi Bowen will cover this more in detail, but I can assure you the word about this, once it gets passed and signed into law, the word's going to get spread in committee meetings and veterans meetings and things like that. And via email contacts, I've got a wide, big contact list of veterans and stuff. And once it's done, the word will go out. I can assure you of that.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Siebels, are there any people in your organization or people that you're aware of who would not, who would like to get the identification but are concerned about their privacy and don't want to be contacted by other folks?
Yes, sir, there probably are some. I can't name anybody offhand, but there are always going to be those who kind of want to stand back and shy away and don't want to get involved. But I see that as a minor problem. I don't think it's a big issue at all. I think the majority of people are going to jump on board this and support it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Siebold? Thank you for your service, sir. Is Jim Sassler there with the VFW, Veterans of Foreign Wars?
Yeah, this is Jim Sassler.
Good morning, sir, and thank you for your service.
Thank you. I appreciate your allowing me a little bit of time here today. I am a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I am
welcome home.
Air Force, and I carry a military ID. First of all, I would be willing to pay for the replacement cost of my driver's license. The last time I had a replacement, I think it cost me $5, and I can certainly afford that. Possibly there's folks that can't, so if there was a program, that would be appreciated. I think that the folks that do have a military ID or veterans medical card, you know, while we don't really need this designator on our license, I think that it's just a way to honor all the veterans that have served. And along with that, as the HB is 180 is currently written, it requires a DD-214, DD-215, or NGB-22 as a identification in order to get this from the DMV. Hopefully an amendment, possibly a regulation change, would allow us just to present our DD-2, which is the military retired ID card or a VA medical card. Because you do have to have one of the other forms of identifications in order to get your Veterans Administration medical ID. And it just save people from having to go and dig the hard copy out to take it along.
Any comment, Representative Sadler, on that?
Thank you, Mr. Vassar, for your service. We received your message about that. while it would probably be my preference to go right to the source of the authorization, that is a certified copy of the discharge document, DD-214-15, or the NGB-22, I would ask Whitney Brewster if, by regulation, we could accept the DD-2 or medical card. The authority is the same source, but just for
Ms. Brewster? Did you hear the question?
I did, Mr. Chairman. I don't see a reason why we couldn't, through regulation, allow for the other documents stated by the, Mr. Vessler.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Again, welcome home. As a Representative Seaton, before you get off the line, sir. I believe it's Representative Seaton.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes, and the question was the current requirement here is that is a retired veteran or veteran serving veteran of the armed forces discharged under honorable conditions. Do those two cards, those other two cards that you're suggesting, carry that same condition that the medical card or the, I think it was the DD-2, are only issued to the people that are covered under that section of discharge under honorable conditions?
I believe so. I know that in order to be a retiree, you definitely are retired under honorable and discharged under honorable conditions. The Veterans Association or Administration medical ID card, again, I believe that in order to be eligible for VA medical care, you have to have been honorably discharged. That I cannot swear to. I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm sure that some of the other veterans that are going to follow me may have that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure somebody following from the department will be able to let us know.
Okay, thank you very much. Bob Miles, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am, and Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing me today.
And thank you for your service.
My name is Bob Miles. I'm currently the state commander for the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I am also a Vietnam veteran.
Welcome home.
And thank you, sir, and I speak for you today in full support of this bill. As been stated myself, I am a service-connected disabled veteran, so I get to carry the VA medical card that designates that, and I do get my discount. And new retirees that carry a military ID card get their discounts, but there are a large number of veterans who served 3, 4, 5, 10 years and who got out of service for whatever reason do not get any kind of card to carry. So, therefore, this designation on a driver's license would be, in my opinion, 100% supported by all veterans.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Miles? If not, again, thank you for your service. Is Joe Field there? I believe you were the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee. This is Joe Field. I am the chair of the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council, and I have found that among informal polling of veterans that we're in contact with, that there's a great deal of support for this issue. One of the areas that is interesting is that, and this is again informal polling of businesses that routinely supply military discounts, that car dealers and furniture and various other stores that I've contacted, they would extend that, according to their management, to people that had a veteran's card, if it was available. They see it as a benefit to them as well as to the veterans. So there's a number of permutations in this, and I know it's broadly supported, and our veterans deserve a good break if they can get one. Incidentally, I am a combat veteran in Vietnam, and I thank you veterans out there for your service.
And thank you for your service, sir, and welcome home from Vietnam. Any questions? If not, let's go to Verdi Bowen, I guess it is, from the Director of Veterans Affairs. Any questions? Do you have any comments you'd like to make, first of all? And I think there may be some questions for you.
Okay. first of all, through the chair, the comment that I wanted to make was about, I'm sorry, this is Bernie Bowen, the Director of Veterans Affairs, and the first comment that I'd like to make is, through the chair, it's about public information, the treatment of the names and the addresses we receive. Those would actually be treated exactly the same way I treat the DD Form 214s and the National Guard Bureau Form 22s that I have here. They're not released to anybody but the individuals. The addresses would be, and the names would actually be used whenever there's a major change within the VA for medical care or for any time that we pass any new legislation within the state that would directly affect veterans, that would allow them to receive enhanced benefits, and then that would go out probably in an annual newsletter of some sort. And that's what our plan was with the addresses. And I hope that covers the privacy concerns.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Gruenberg, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The requirement in the bill is that the veteran must have been discharged under honorable conditions. And Mr. Bowen, might there, and it's been quite a while since I had any knowledge of the differences between types of discharges, would there be any reason that this should be extended to anybody else?
No, sir. Under honorable conditions covers actually general and honorable discharge, which is honorable conditions. That's the wording that you have there is the same wording the VA uses when they issue their medical ID cards, and they provide other benefits for those veterans.
If I may follow up.
Follow up.
We asked the Division of Motor Vehicles some questions about efforts to publicize these new cards or designations. What efforts can the Division of Veterans Affairs make, and will that require statutory change? Will there be a cost?
Through the chair, no, there would not be a statutory cost. The first thing I would do is do a public service announcements through the media in order to reach everything. And currently right now, we have undertaking an outreach effort, which we're hitting 100, I want to say, villages or areas off of the roadways each year. And that is between my department and all of our veteran service officers. And that would be another venue that we would use to get the information out. Also, we would utilize all of our veteran service organizations, which is the Military Order of the Purple Heart, VFW, American Legion, DAV, and AMVETS, in order to reach all of our veterans throughout the communities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I appreciate that. My suggestions are that there are some veterans who are not plugged in and may, you know, be people who have modest means, or they may have their not any means at all. And this may be a good opportunity for the Division of Veterans Affairs to toot their own horn a little bit, like through senior centers and the medical community and hospitals and stuff, because this is an opportunity that doesn't come along very often to alert people in the general population, hey, if you're a veteran, you know, you can get a designation, and this may be something that you'll want to do, because they have things like burial benefits and stuff. And I would hope that you could use not just the traditional veterans network, but other places people our generation go.
Any comment? Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gruenberg, if there's a better public information service than the veterans grapevine, I've yet to hear of it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Vaughn. We have Rick Davidge from the, looks like, Vietnam Veterans of America. Are you online, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and welcome home.
Same to you, sir.
Let me take a little different tactic on this. As you know, finding our veterans has been one of the top priorities of VBA and of the foundation for some years. And just put forward the question, why is it important that we find our veterans? Yes, the discounts are nice. Yes, the recognition is nice. But there's some other reasons, and Bertie and I have talked about this. We find out more and more as the days go by about the exposure to toxins. Vietnam veterans were famous for their exposure to Agent Orange. And we're finding out more and more about what Agent Orange does, not only to the veterans, but also their children. Providing this information on a regular basis to veterans across the state of Alaska would, one, alert them that this is something that they should be concerned with, and if they have a particular disease or malady that is listed within the presumptive disabilities exposure, for example, to Agent Orange, or the burn pits in the current war, they could alert their medical professionals. In addition, every doctor, every medical professional in the state of Alaska should ask any patient that walks in the door, are you a veteran? Emergency medicine people are learning that they need to ask this or to find out if their patient is a veteran, because it changes in many cases the diagnosis of the situation. It may change the treatment. It may change the prescriptions that are provided, because they may intuitively know through a computer search that someone who is a veteran in a current war that may be exposed to neurotoxin needs to be treated a little differently than someone who's not. So there are a lot of other reasons for this to be on a driver's license.
Thank you. One more question, and we need to go on to the next bill. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Davidge, that was exactly what I was getting at. People in my generation who served in Vietnam, many of them would rather forget about that. They don't have anything to do with veterans organizations. The younger veterans who were in Gulf War, who were over in Iraq and Afghanistan and who knows where, may feel differently now. But there's a whole generation of people that really would rather bury that memory. And these are the people that I am very concerned about. And, Mr. Chair, this is the heart of this. This is an opportunity to get these people in and notified. And I would like to know from Mr. Bowen what can be done to notify these people, and because this gets them on public health lists, and some of them would rather die literally than be associated with or know this. This is a very difficult issue. Could I ask Mr. Bowen? Please.
Through the chair.
No, wait. Mr. Bowen.
Very difficult issue. And many times when we go out into the bush, we don't need, especially in the remote communities throughout the state, we usually go to either the Native headquarters offices, through the schools, through the churches, so that we can draw those groups of people that feel alienated by the VA or by the federal government. And those are the people that we target each time that we go out. And each time that we go out, we find more and more people. And Mr. Davies and I talk about this all the time. There are so many presumptive illnesses due to Agent Orange. And a lot of our Vietnam-era veterans are suffering from these. And they really are the hardest group. And which is, this is something I want to add. The Vietnam veteran group is the reason we have a lot of the programs we have today, because of the way they were treated. They came home and fixed a lot of our problems over the last 30 years. But they're also the same group that we have the hardest time reaching because of the trust factor. And so we have to be very inventive. We've used the National Guard Yellow Ribbon Team for reconnecting veterans and sent them into the community. And those were all done through churches and through schools and through hospitals. And we reached 261 villages over the last 18 months total. And in that, we probably reached about 1,000 Vietnam-era veterans that needed health care of one sort or another. And so it gives you an idea of the reach efforts that we have tried. And the driver's license is another way to try and draw these guys in to get them information on their illnesses. And what I'm hoping, and I'm a person that is married, and I know Rick also is, that if something comes from the VA in the mail, my wife generally reads it, even if I don't look at it.
and she'll inform me something that I need. And what I'm hoping is that through our outreach efforts, we not only reach the veteran, but we also reach the spouses too as well to help us to entice them to come in for these cares.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else online to testify? Anybody else?
Chairman, just one other final point, if I may. One of the other ways to look at veterans is veterans are an economic engine in the state. Veterans generate, in this state, over $2 billion of economic activity, either directly through benefits, retirement, et cetera. And that's been well documented, and Bertie's been working on that as well. Letting our veterans know that they have benefits, they have services, et cetera, not only improves the life of the veteran, but improves the life of the family of that veteran, mm-hmm. as Bertie's pointed out. And yes, we generally find, I get the calls from the sisters and the mothers and the wives of veterans, not always from veterans. So getting this information out there, again, is important, not just for discounts, not just for recognition, but for medical services, emergency medical services, and for the lives of our veteran families. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and certainly our sponsor for moving this bill forward.
Thank you very much, and I do want to get this out of committee so we can accomplish all these good things that we've been talking about here. Representative Peterson, final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually had one quick question for Whitney Brewster. I was wondering if the veterans' but driver's license was not due to expire, if they'd be able to renew this driver's license through the mail. So they wouldn't have to come into the DMV.
Ms. Brewster?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, when they come in for the first time, they will be required to come in initially to show us proof of veteran status. But after that, we will have it in the DMV system, so they could go about renewing through the mail. We would continue to have that designation within our records, so they would be able to experience that convenience.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Satan.
Thank you. And Ms. Brewster, just to clarify that under the section we have it where we're identifying it as an identification card, that includes both the ID and a driver's license. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. It's my understanding that this designation would be available for both driver's licenses and identification cards.
Okay. One follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. And that is, on line 10, it says, to receive the veteran identification, the person shall provide these forms to the department as proof. You were saying that you could take other forms by regulation, and I'm not sure that you have the ability to do that if we designate in statute only these forms can be done. So do you have any objection to also listing the DD-2 and the veteran medical card as alternatives in that sentence?
Through the chair, Representative Stephen, the DMV is not opposed to including other forms of identification to show proof of veteran status. The DMV could certainly ask for legal guidance as to whether or not we have the ability to accept other forms of identification as established through regulation, but I think it may be clearer and easier just to simply write it into the statute.
Into the statute, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do you want to make a conceptual amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'd make a conceptual amendment that, you know, probably on line 12 following NGB 22, we add DD-2 or veteran medical card. And, of course, that's a conceptual amendment that I would move.
Yeah. Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
Point of order.
First of all, we're still in public testimony.
That's
and
true.
I have questions for Ms. Brewster on this. And
let's hold off on that, and we'll do it again when we close public testimony. But we've got to get to the other bill here soon, yes.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Brewster. First to Representative Seaton's comment. Could we simply delete page 1, line 9, starting with A, and just delete the specific form so it would read, to receive a veteran designation, the driver shall provide proof of veteran status, and leave it up to the DMV to be in charge of deciding which documents would be acceptable. Is that the solution?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, that would certainly be an option that we could establish what specific identification for veteran status would be allowable, and would certainly look at the conversation that occurred in this committee to put those requirements within the regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. Then I want to ask the sponsors comment on this. And yes.
Right. And then a couple questions about the fiscal note, if I might, very quickly, Mr. Chairman. Can the, Ms. Brewster, can you administratively decide that you're going to charge 85 cents per license, or do you need specific statutory direction to charge, quote, at cost for these licenses?
Representative Johansson, we could not just administratively decide to charge the 85 cents. The fee associated with driver licensing, identification cards, duplicates are all listed in statute.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, very quickly, if I might. So if I simply amended the fiscal note, that would not accomplish what I want to do. You can simply shift your authority around and follow statute as you are required.
Representative Johansson, that is correct. We would still be required under statute to charge the fees.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Reverend Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the question of whether proof of veteran status as opposed to the specific forms designated in statute, as long as we could reliably, you know, we could rely on that, I would not be averse to that.
And Ms. Wilson, Representative Wilson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We would have to change it on both pages because it goes on and mentions it again on the second page. So,
okay. And you, what's the wish of the committee? Well, any final comments?
No, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're going to close public testimony. Thank you, everybody, who took your time to testify. Representative Seaton?
What?
Oh, Representative Wilson. Well, somebody. Is somebody going to make a motion on this or not? Is there going to be an amendment?
I think if we discussed a little bit, I think it would be a little bit cleaner if we did it with what Representative Johansson mentioned. I think
I don't want to have competing amendments.
Yeah, that's
Mr. Chairman, I'll...
Representative Johansson, do you have a...
Thank you.
I'll
move conceptual amendment number one that...
Wait, stand by. I didn't hear.
Okay.
I will we never moved. Did we move your amendment? Okay, would you withdraw your amendment?
I did.
Withdraw. So this would be amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman, I move conceptual amendment number two, which is as follows. Line 11, after provide, delete a United States Department of Defense form DD-214 or DD-215 or a National Guard Bureau form NGB-22. That would be the end of the deletion, so it would read, to receive a veteran's designation, the person shall provide to the department as proof, et cetera, et cetera. Following on page 2, line 6, after provide, delete a United States Department of Defense form, et cetera, until page 2, line 8, after as, so it would read, starting on line 6, to receive a veteran's designation, the driver shall provide proof of veteran status, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Is there any objection to the amendment?
Just for the purpose of discussion.
For purpose of discussion, quickly, Representative Grunberg, please.
Just for the record, the word as on page 1, line 12 is also being deleted. So it would be provide proof in both cases. That'd be the same language, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sponsor's nodding. Thank you, Mr.
Well, yes, and this is a conceptual amendment.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So they'll take care of that in legislative drafting, right?
Well, I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Thank you. Any objection? Amendment number two passes. I'll entertain a motion on the bill from somebody. Not everybody at once, please.
I'll move the bill with individual recommendations.
Okay. Reverend, okay. Any objection? Okay. Objection?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll object for one comment.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
First of all, I don't think there was a proper motion made, but
that's correct.
I thought I made the motion. I move.
I move as a proper motion.
I move the bill as amended in the committee substitute with accompanying fiscal note with individual recommendation.
And I'll object for a quick comment.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
I will just let the sponsor know that I hope that the Finance Committee will look at putting language in that will provide this service at cost to the DMV. The director commented that it had no impact on their operations, and it would end up being about a $26,000 cost to all of those veterans. And if I don't see it in finance, I'll bring an amendment to the floor, and just a heads up to the sponsor. And that's usually a pretty good place to get a veterans amendment passed, by the way. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I would like to make a comment that it's a little onerous if we say at cost. The cost is 85 cents. So I think, you know, a dollar or $2 or something like that, but not just 85 cents. I mean, round it off at least.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Just a clarification. That's only the cost of printer ribbons. So you got to go down to the cost to duplicate and the cost to in fiscal year 12 and 13, just for clarification.
We're getting down in the weeds on this. Representative Sadler.
Through the chair to the Representative Johansson and Seaton, yes, I will take it up with the Finance Committee to talk about trying to make that adjustment. I appreciate the impulse on that, and we'll see if we can
get it. Are the objections to moving this bill?
Yes.
Okay. This bill moved from committee. Congratulations. I'm really looking forward to the floor session this morning, where we have a very simple HB 110, a very simple bill that we'll be able to get through with perhaps less debate than we've had on this one.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to thank you very much for your time. Appreciate the question.
Thanks. Quick ideas. House State Affairs Committee, will please come to order. We're not going to consider CS for House Bill number 78, CRA, an act relating to election practices and procedures providing for an effective date. We have representative of the sponsor for the bill. Will you please introduce yourself and tell us about this bill?
My name is Cecile Elliott, staff representative Bill Thomas.
Will you speak up just a little more loudly, please?
Sure. Cecile Elliott, staff to Representative Bill Thomas. In the spirit of the previous bill, this bill also does much to support our veterans. In 2009, Congress passed the MOVE Act, which outlines procedures to make it easier for our military and overseas voters to vote. There's been several communications back and forth with the division regarding this, and those should be in your packet. Overseas military personnel and civilians represent 61,000 of Alaska's eligible voters. These voters face a myriad of challenges when pursuing the fundamental right to vote. Additionally, we had 41,000 voters who voted absentee in Alaska. This bill also expands absentee voting in general for those voters as well. CS for House Bill 178 moves the primary back 2 weeks. Before I continue, the MOVE Act established that states needed to provide 45-day transmittal time of a ballot. So that means we send a ballot out 45 days ahead of time so that military and overseas voters have the appropriate amount of time to return their ballot. This there was a study done by Pew in 2009 that established, that looked at all the issues challenging voters. That was the number one issue. That was put out in January. The MOVE Act was passed in October 2009. So I'll go over much of the bill deals with that issue of the 45-day ballot turnaround and providing for that in a couple of different ways. So one moves the primary back 2 weeks. It also removes the witnessing requirements to alleviate the burden of our military voters from finding a witness when stationed remotely. It establishes the electronic transmission of ballot information and ballots. It changes the deadline for overseas voters because the provision of bumping up the primary provides time on that end. This bill establishes right now a military and overseas voter, we can receive their ballot 15 days post-election. Regular absentee ballots are 10. This provision is just 10 days for both, given that we provide the time on the other end for the ballot to be received. This also, section one of the bill, provides for a child who is the son or daughter of parents who lived in Alaska prior to going overseas. That child comes of age. They don't have a state to vote in. This allows them to vote in a presidential election. There are a couple of other provisions in the bill that make general absentee voting a little more accessible. One is that the division explained that ballots are ready in the regional offices 22 days ahead of time. In statute, it says that you can't get a ballot until 15 days ahead of time. The reason for that is there's a transmittal time getting the ballots to various places. But so this bill provides for if the ballots are there in the regional office, someone can request and receive them. And so that's 22 days. And that they're available in other places 15 days later, and that's simply just the time frame to get the ballots there. Also, another provision of this bill, how this bill began, is that it provides for municipal clerks to act as election officials for the purpose of administering absentee ballots. There were two changes made to the bill in community regional affairs, and that was making letter of intent, declaration of candidacy, public record, information in that public record. It also provides for an opportunity if the, well, provides the division if they find a candidate ineligible and then they change that decision, that they notify the parties involved in that information exchange, the person who made the complaint, the candidate in question, and other candidates. That the division sends a written notification of that change. And with that, I'll stand by for any questions, answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Representative Gornberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have, I don't seem to have in my packet the original bill. I have the CNRA committee substitute, and I have an X-ray draft. Do you want us to consider this new CS?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Okay, I will.
So I will
move.
Yes.
The adoption of that, and I hope somebody objects because I'd like to know the difference. So I will move the X-ray.
Just one moment. I'm being told by this has already been read across the floor.
We have the CNRA. But there is another later version.
Oh.
No. Just.
At ease. Go ahead.
Excuse me.
Record.
Mr. Chair, my question, I had a couple of questions here, and I went through this with my aide last night. I'm not sure. My first question relates to what you said on Section 1. Does Section 1 only allow the child to vote in a presidential election, no other election?
Through the chair, yes. Would you like me to explain?
Well, just for a second. So this is a child of an Alaskan family who turns voting age when they're outside the state. Is there a reason why that child shouldn't be allowed to vote into the election district of the family for all election, you know, for all of the races, U.S. Senate and State House and anything else?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, and I know Gail Fenumia is online.
Yeah, she is online.
If you are not an Alaska resident, you cannot vote in the state race constitutionally.
Through the chair.
Let's go to, let's hold that. We'll bring Ms. Fenumia up right after she's done here.
And my second question, Mr. Chair, relates to a repealer. And if the members would look at Section 27 on the last page, line 20, the statute I'm referring to is the very first statute, 1520.081H. And there are some other statutes that relate to this repealer. But this was the one that caught my eye. And let me read that. 1520.081H says, except as provided in 1524.80, an absentee ballot returned by mail from outside the U.S. or from an overseas voter, et cetera, that has been marked and mailed not later than election day may not be counted unless the ballot is received by the election supervisor not later than the close of business on the 15th day following the election. My question is, if we repeal that, is there going to be a cutoff? Because there has to be some cutoff. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, that's the 10-day cutoff post-election. That's why that's removed, because it was 15 days for military and overseas voters. We could receive a ballot 15 days post-election. Regular absentee ballots is 10. This changes the receipt of that post-election ballot 10 days rather than 15, and that's why that's repealed, because it wouldn't we don't need it because we've changed it in another provision in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I am confused, because I could see somebody outside in a foxhole or something, that's kind of a generic term, not being able to get the ballot back until 15 days later. Why the shorter period? Will that not disenfranchise some people?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, that's a good question. And the reason being is that we've provided extra time on the front end of that. So we're moved, the primaries move back 2 weeks. So that provides, so we can give them a ballot 45 days ahead of time, which was what the studies show is the need for those. And also there's one more provision in the bill that shortens the time and expands the opportunity for voting, and that is to receive a ballot by email.
I saw that. That's excellent. If I may, one more question.
One more question.
There is in here, and I'm not sure which number it is in the bill, but a section that changes the date of the primary election. What section is that?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, it's section 14.
Yeah. If the members would look, it's at the bottom of page 7. It's changed from the fourth Tuesday in August to the second Tuesday in August. Do you see where we're talking about?
I'm looking at 30.
Okay, it's on page 7, line 30. And this is a very important change, and I need to have some justification, serious justification for doing that. That's going to shorten the campaign time and all kinds of things. And we have some questions.
Do you want her to answer first, and then we go to the other?
I would rather get the, because this may relate to the question. Okay.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. In the sponsor statement, on the first, if you go to the sponsor statement, it says moves the primary back 2 weeks. Well, that would tell me that it would be 2 weeks longer.
Yeah.
I mean, before it happens. But in here, it says the primary is held on the second Tuesday in August instead of the fourth. So that's moving it back instead of
forward.
Oh, yeah, that's moving it forward instead of back.
Yes.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, poor choice of words. You're correct that it is moving the primary up 2 weeks earlier. Yes, that's correct.
And forward and up and back. How about just earlier and later? Make it a little easier.
Okay. It moves it 2 weeks forward.
That'd be 2 weeks later or 2 weeks.
That would give them 2 weeks less time.
Let's don't have a big conversation. Go ahead, please.
And if I may, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, to answer your question about why that is and the justification for that, is that the MOVE Act is a federal act with where there's been communications with the department that we have to provide for this, and the division has communicated that this is the way that it can be done.
And we'll go to Ms. Numiai in just a moment. Representative Seaton.
Just for clarity, and do I understand then that to provide the 45 days for the ballots to go out, the primary needs to be moved earlier so that we can comply with the 45-day federal requirement? Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct. And just as a point of information, and Gail can give more details, but in order to print an official ballot, there has to be a determination of who is going to be on the ballot, hence moving it forward in order to have certainty about that in order to produce the ballot.
Okay. I'm going to call Ms. Numiai. Now, are you online?
Oh.
And then we can,
yes, I am.
Would you make some just general comments? I think we have several questions from the committee here, and we'll get to all of your questions on the committee. Just make some comments first of what you've heard so far. Ms. Numiai.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would like to start with Representative Gruenberg's comment.
Well, and then first of all, identify yourself for the clerk here.
Gail Dion, Division of Elections.
Thank you.
Would you like me to start first with Representative
Gruenberg? Well, just try any place to be most convenient to answer some of the questions that we've had so far, and I suspect there are going to be more.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg asked a question about why in Section 1 those specific group of voters would only be eligible to vote in a, it would be a federal election, so they would be able to vote for all federal offices. And the reason for that is in order to qualify to vote in state elections, you actually have to have been a resident of the state and a House district in which you seek to vote for at least 30 days prior to the election. And those children of those voters, of those parents who had resided in Alaska prior to leaving, their parents meet that qualification and are still eligible to vote in state elections. However, their children actually never physically resided in that House district 30 days before the election. Therefore, Section 1 allows children whose parents are overseas and they turn age 18 and wish to vote, they can be an overseas voter, which means they are only eligible to vote in federal elections.
Mr. Chair, may I inquire?
Representative Gruenberg.
My recollection, Ms. Finumiai, is that a child, assuming that child was alive when the family left Alaska, became an Alaska resident at that time, even though they're a minor. There is nothing in the law that says a minor cannot become a resident. In fact, they do. You know, minors are residents of the state. And number two, and we have, I think we have Alpheus Bullard on the line. My other recollection from my conflicts of laws class is that if a parent is a resident of a state, that also impacts whether their child is a resident, assuming that they haven't lived elsewhere. I think that is an incorrect legal assumption, and I'd like, before we really take this thing up, to know is I'm very concerned if that child cannot vote in the Alaska.
Ms. Finumiai. Ms. Finumiai?
Yes, through the chair, Ms. Gruenberg, I would defer the legal interpretation of that if Mr. Bullard is available to answer that.
Yes, he's online.
If Mr. Bullard could answer that question for you.
Mr. Bullard, are you online, sir?
Chair, Chairman, yes, I am.
Please identify yourself and try to answer that question.
For the record, this is Alpheus Bullard. I'm an attorney with Legislative Legal Services.
Thank you.
And through the chair, Representative Broomberg, Article 5, Section 1 provides that a voter for the immediately preceding the election that they must be a 30-day resident of the election district in which they seek to vote, except for the purposes of voting for president or vice president. So this provision is crafted to comply with that constitutional provision.
Representative Grunberg.
Okay. It says, every citizen of the United States who is at least 18 years of age, who meets the registration residency requirements, which may be prescribed by law and who is qualified to vote under this article, may vote in any state or local election. A voter shall have been immediately preceding the election, a 30-day resident of the election district for which he seeks to vote, except for President of the United States, except for presidency and vice presidency. However, it seems to me, as a matter of law, that if a child was a resident when they left Alaska, that residency as a matter of law continues, even though they may have been out of the state, they did not change their residency. And this is very important. I would be very hesitant to deny these kids the right to vote without getting a judicial decision on that. I would like you to, Mr. Chair, I'm very serious about this.
I know you are.
Some legal research on that if we're not going to extend this thing to allow them to vote throughout the ballot. And I think we should err on the side of including them in here and let some judge say that, because I don't read the thing the same way you do. Do you have any authority to support your comment there?
Through the chair, if that is a comment directed at me, if that child who is over 18 was a resident, they are already able to vote. What this first section of the bill does is expand the voting franchise to those children who have never been a resident of Alaska or a house district, but are the children of people who were, who is now of age, and this allows them to vote through the Alaska election processes for president and vice president. I wouldn't describe this as narrowing the franchise, but expanding it.
Reverend Grunberg?
I think I'm going to want to talk to Mr. Bullard privately. I don't need to take up the committee's time. This is a confusing section to me.
Thank you. And you'd like to continue? Ms. Fanumia, any other comments, what you've heard so far?
On the primary.
On primary or anything else?
There was, Mr. Chairman, there was also a question by Representative Grunberg why the repeal of 1520.081H was, why that section was being repealed. Mm-hmm. And that provision does allow for ballots that were postmarked overseas to be received for up to 15 days following the election. But with ballots now being required to be mailed to this group of voters, military and overseas voters, 45 days before the election, they are actually receiving their ballots about 23 days before they ever have before. So they are gaining time on the front end when they get their ballots, but then shortening it by 5 days on the end. So they still are having more time to receive their ballots, vote it, and get it, to vote it, get it back to the division.
Sure. Representative Grunberg?
Yes.
And then Wilson.
This is getting to the second question I had, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to sort of be monopolizing the time here.
It's okay. You're doing well for me. Go ahead.
I am concerned, and just so I'm on the record here, my policy is to allow as many people to vote as possible. That's my lodestar here.
I think that applies to all of us.
And my question is, why not keep them and give them that extra day? It may not make a difference for very many people, but what is the harm in allowing them that extra 5 days through the chair?
Ms. Fanumia.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, The difficulties with allowing that extra 5 days post-primary election set some difficulties to get ballots mailed timely to voters for the general election due to all the post-primary processes that have to happen. The State Review Board would not be able to certify the election until a period of time later, because we would have that extra 5 days of which ballots can be received. It impacts everything that happens in order to get a final ballot certified and prepared to get mailed for the general election.
May I follow up, please?
Yes, and then we're going to go to Representative Wilson.
Do we get very many ballots in that last 5 days? Because you've been doing it now. That's just the current practice, and you're able to do it now. How many people would be disenfranchised, and why couldn't you just continue because you're doing it now?
For the chair, Representative Groomberg, the 2010 general election was the very first time in which the division was required to meet the requirements of the MOVE Act, getting ballots 45 days before the election, to military and overseas voters. We had 3 days in which to prepare ballots and get them to voters because of other deadlines. Embassy withdrawal deadlines was 48 days before the election. The more time the division has between the certification of the primary election and prepping to get ballots mailed for the general election, more likely it will ensure that the division will be able to comply 100% with the requirements of the MOVE Act. Knocking 5 days off on the post-primary processes assists that in happening. My recollection is I don't have exact numbers, but it is less than 50 ballots, and granted, I believe 50 ballots is 50 ballots, and every ballot is important, that did come in within that five-day window. That's an estimate. I do not have hardcore statistics at this time, but I can definitely get them for the committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about this also, and the reason being is Alaska people need to know that if they get that postmarked by the day of election, at least, then that they should be able to, if they stick that in the mail, that there should be plenty of time. And even if there's 50 or less than 50, it doesn't make any difference. They should still have the right to have their ballot counted. I don't care if it's only one. We've had elections that have been won or lost by one ballot, and I think that's important. Now, is the requirement for the 10 days in the, we're trying to match the federal, I don't remember what you called it. It's a four-letter word that you called whatever we are trying to move in the MOVE rules. Does it say you have only 10 days, or is that just because you would like to have 10 days because people would like to know sooner whether they won or not?
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's the Military Overseas Voter Empowerment Act, which is the acronym is MOVE, does not speak to the time frame for when ballots can be received back by states. And different states have a variety of different times for when those ballots can be received. And it's not for the purposes of finding out, so people know who won faster. It helps with the post-primary election processes in order to certify a ballot and get it to the printer and be able to accommodate and meet that 45-day ballot mailing deadline as required by the federal law.
Reverend Wilson, follow-up?
But I understand the 45 days ahead of time, and that's fine. I don't care about that. But what I do care about is giving people, you know, in Alaska, we're further away from all different kinds of things. And I really question shortening it to 10 days. Extending it at the front, I don't have a problem with. It's shortening it at the end. I mean, so what? So they have more time to look at it. People have a tendency many times to not do it until that last day. Oh, yeah, today's election day. People have a right to not vote till that day here in the United States. And if they're serving our country somewhere else, they should have the right to not do it till election day also.
Comment? Where's...
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I guess I'm all ballots. Everybody has a right to vote up to election day. If the ballot is postmarked on election day. And this provision, just what it did was all ballots received by 10 days following the election, irregardless of where they come from.
Okay.
I'd be happy to get statistics to the committee and provide further information. I'm sure that this is going to. This bill is going to require a lot more discussion by your committee at this point.
I think so. With that in mind, I have a question for Representative Johansson, and then I'm going to hold this bill until perhaps, our next committee meeting, but I want to get Representative Johansson's bill in. I still want to get to the next bill quickly at least. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I listened to the explanation from the Division of Elections, and it didn't quite make sense. And I just want to put it out there for people to think about, and then I have a question for the sponsors, staff.
Okay. A comment, Ms. Funumiya, then I'll go to the staff.
Well, I don't want to hear her comment.
Okay.
I have a comment
for
the committee. I don't want to hear Gail Funumiya reply. I haven't.
And do you want to hear from the sponsor at all first and then make your comment, or vice versa, or what?
I'm just going to start talking. If that
Please start good. Talking. The clock is ticking.
Thank you. The explanation by elections was we need more time between the primary and the general to do our business. Well, if the primary is being moved back 2 weeks, earlier 2 weeks, 14 extra days, and we do not repeal this, the net gain for elections between the primary and the general is 9 additional days. So I don't see how they're going to have a problem with any more time.
But not if we don't move it.
Please, go ahead.
That is, if we do not repeal AS 1520-081-H, if it stays status quo, we have 9 extra days between the primary and the general. So I don't buy the argument from elections. My question for the sponsor is Section 27, that portion that Representative Grunberg brought up, was that something that the sponsor is excited about? Was that language brought to the sponsor? I'd like to know what the motivation of it being in the bill, something that's important to Representative Thomas, then I'll have to talk to him or you about why it's in there.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, we worked with the division in order to accommodate move. Taking the 5 days off allows the division with greater ease to provide for that 45-day. So I'm not sure why it's being I understand that it's being interpreted as less time, but the whole intention of the bill is to provide more time for these voters to vote. And if the ballots are received in the time frames of this bill, then the division has a greater ability to provide for these voters. I'm sorry, that didn't sound very clear, but it is our understanding that this is the process and the time frames in order to accommodate this.
Okay, Representative Johansson.
Thank you. By keeping the current statute, you are getting to your goal of providing more time because you're keeping 5 extra days. The time prior to the election, I understand what you're trying to get at. It's the changing from 15 to 10 days. The director of elections testified it had nothing to do with move. It's simply something that she testified that it would cause problems between the primary and the general of getting their work done. And I, maybe I misinterpreted. I don't want to beat it to death because I know we're going to hold the bill, so I'll be happy to talk to the division director.
And I'm going to go to Representative Wilson next, but I want to at least get started on the next bill because of the time constraints of this whole session here. Representative Wilson, and then we're going to hold the bill.
Okay. I suggest if that 5 days is so important, then instead of putting the election the second week in August, put it the first week in August.
Okay. I think we have a good topic. We're going to have some interesting times with this bill on the next hearing, I am sure. Thank you for presenting this. In the meantime, I invite the committee to talk with Representative Thomas about any and all aspects of this bill and where we're going to go with it. And with that, we're going to hold this bill, and I'm going to invite Representative Feige to come forward for HB 190, PFD allowable absence in the military. I'm sorry we don't have more time on it, but I at least wanted to get this process started so we can make a full consideration on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Representative Eric Feige from House District 12. I direct your attention first to the sponsor statement attached to HB 190 and the quote down at the bottom. We sleep soundly in our beds because rough men stand ready in the night to visit violence on those who would do us harm. Keep that in mind. House Bill 190 provides an exemption from the 10-year rule for those individuals who are truly Alaska residents that choose to serve our country by joining the armed forces of the United States. Once an individual joins the armed forces, their physical location is beyond their control. In order to serve outside Alaska, military members go as ordered and with pride for their country and their home state of Alaska. We ask them to volunteer, and they go to defend our national interests. In 1998, members of our legislature decided someone that was absent from the state for specific reasons, including service in the military, should be eligible to receive a PFD. The law enacted in that year also contained a provision that limited the allowed absence to no more than 10 years, with the exception of members of Congress and their staff. While the enactment of the 10-year rule may have been appropriate to exempt those serving in Congress and not exempt those serving in the military, it strikes me as an injustice. You now have the opportunity to correct this injustice. We have provided a CS for House Bill 190 to clarify the originally proposed exemption so that someone who is out of state on an approved absence, such as a dependent who continues to be eligible to receive a PFD, cannot simply join the military and continue to receive the PFD for more than 10 years. This would be a dependent, somebody, in most cases, other military members that come from outside and then go on, claiming Alaska residency for a variety of reasons, but not truly having grown up here in Alaska. So this is this exemption is to specifically address folks that grow up here in the state, that volunteer to serve in the armed forces, and then should be eligible to receive, so that we are not penalizing them for taking up a career in the U.S. military.
Thank you very much. And before we go further, I would ask someone to make a motion to adopt the CS version D for discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
I move the CS for 190 version D before us for a working document.
I'll object for discussion.
Okay, object for discussion. Any other comment? Do you have a question right now? Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I actually do. By the way, just for the members' information, I'm looking at page 1. I haven't gotten over to page 2. I'm going to have to just look at this more.
That's fine.
I don't understand it yet. Yeah. If somebody, maybe Representative Feige could.
If there any, if there any general comments, anybody can make comments at this time. We're not going to have time to explore this too much because we're about to adjourn here, and some of us need to prepare for important discussions on the floor session. But if you just make some generalized questions to somebody right now, so we can, so give the sponsor time to think about this. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, if the sponsor could provide us with a legal memo on how this differs from the situation of longevity bonus, where we were looking at the length of stay a person had and discriminating between residents on their length of stay, because I think that we run into a Zobel kind of problem here where that's been declared illegal. And so if you could provide us a legal memo discerning this from that case, that would be helpful. And also for our discussion, if you could obtain from the Permanent Fund Division the percentage of returnees after they have military as well as other allowable absence, how many return to Alaska, because of course the allowable absences are a proxy for residency, and with our students, once they're, if they're gone for 2 years, they have a 68% return rate. That's what it was a few years ago. But if they're gone for 4 years to school, it's down into the 30s. And the return rate on military independence after the 10 years was down into the 20s or lower. And so the question, it's also a legal question of if that becomes too far away from a proxy for residency, does it put at risk the permanent fund being declared a taxable item by the United States? That was the question. The permanent fund currently is non-taxable because the distributions are only to residents, and the further, as the testimony received in State Affairs before was from the Permanent Fund Division, that the further you get away and the more tenuous that allowable absence becomes for a proxy for physical residence, the more likely it is that the federal government will declare the entire permanent fund a taxable entity, because the use of those funds are for persons. So if you could get us a legal opinion on those so that we can know that we're not getting into funny water, that'd be helpful.
Okay. Representative Wilson. Generalized question, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to add on to that. To see if the 10 years was connected to that in some way, that we would do it, because we all know that there's a lot of military people that come up here that have no intention to come back, but they claim that dividend for as long as they can. And see if that, ask them while you're at it, to see if the 10 years is because of that lawsuit or not, because even if we put 8 years, that would make a difference. And I'm happy that veterans are protecting us. I don't mean that, but the ones that really have no intention of coming back here but are still claiming that dividend, just check that out if you would.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I understand. Just to clarify, this is for people that are have a record of being Alaska residents prior to being inducted into the armed forces. This really does not apply to people that come up here and get stationed and beyond that. Okay.
I totally understand that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We're about out of time here. I have two. Looks like two individuals here would like to testify on this, and we are very short of time. If I could get very, very quick testimony from these two people, I don't want to inconvenience you by having to come back another time. So I'm going to go to Peter Crowfoot first. Please identify yourself, who you represent, and make your comments very brief, please. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am, sir. Thanks very much for taking the time to hear me. I'll make this as brief as I can.
We got about 3 minutes for two people.
Okay. Thank you very much. I understand the reticence with everybody there. To give you a quick background of the kind of people who are being denied their permits on dividend, I have been Alaska resident since I was 4 years old. I am currently an active duty lieutenant commander in the United States Navy SEAL teams on the East Coast. And I am actually on an active range right now calling in because I feel like this is an important issue. That being said, I attended Tri Valley High School just outside of Denali National Park. I went to kindergarten to 12th grade in Alaska. The only reason I left Alaska was to attend the United States Naval Academy. And then I was active duty for the past 13 years at that point. At the 10-year mark, the bill in question precluded me from getting my PFD, and I have since not gotten it for the past 3 years. I have voted in all Alaska elections. As I said, I've been a resident since I was 4 years old. I have an Alaska driver's license. I have property in Alaska, and I am part owner in a family business in Alaska. I have, for every year that I have been gone, qualified for both the 5-year and the 72-hour rules to qualify as a active duty military person and still receive the permanent fund dividend, which I did up until the 10-year rule kicked in. So I understand the residents with respect to the permanent fund dividend being taxed, and I understand the residents for people trying to milk the system. Unfortunately, myself and a couple other individuals have every intention of Alaska remaining their home. As far as the military is concerned, I have listed it as my home of record, and I intend to return there when I retire. My intention for all of you listening to this is simply to change the permanent fund dividend to reflect an intention by the state and the permanent fund itself not to penalize members of the military who decide to make it a career choice. I thank you all for taking the time to hear this in my testimony, and I hope you give it some serious consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your service, and keep your head down there, okay? Lieutenant Colonel Brian Ross, are you there?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Thank you for your service. Please identify yourself and make very brief testimony. We're out of time, but we're going to listen to you.
Okay,
We don't mess around with Marines, okay?
My name is Lieutenant Colonel Brian Ross. I'm in the U.S. Marine Corps. I'm actually testifying to you today from Okinawa, Japan. It's Friday, the 1st of April, about 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not an April Fool's joke, but I will be leaving my sleeping family in a few hours to go for a month to the Philippines on a military exercise. And I wanted my voice heard in full support of House Bill 190. My story is the same as Tico Crowfoot's that you just heard. I was born in Alaska in 1972. Joined the Marine Corps in 1990, served in combat twice, once in 2003, once in 2005. I got the first PFD check given to Alaskans at age 10. I don't know how many of you remember getting that first $1,000 check, but I did, and I certainly do. I have an Alaska driver's license since turning age 16. I've registered to vote in Alaska since turning 18 in 1990. My last will and testament designates my residency in Alaska. And will be executed in the event of my death in the state of Alaska. Those are just my paper ties, but I also have physical ties as well. I also own property near Glen Allen since 1999. Both my parents and my two brothers live in Alaska. Made dozens of trips back to Alaska, at least 80 days in the last 5 years alone. Most recently in Alaska in December, getting home for Christmas, taking an Air Force cargo plane for 9 hours across the Pacific, but it was well worth it. I, too, was denied my dividend in 2009, and I've chosen to take the state of Alaska to court and file a Superior Court judicial review as allowed under Alaska statutes. I ask you, am I less deserving of a PFD because I've chosen a military career which exceeds an arbitrary 10 years but might meet all the other requirements? If I'm not an Alaska resident, then where do you suggest is my home? The only reason I don't live in Alaska is because I've chosen a career in the U.S. Marine Corps that began 8 years before Alaska Statute 43.23.00C became law. Upon my retirement from the service, I intend to return to Alaska to live permanently and have sworn to that fact on every PFD application for the last 20 years. Alaska, as my home of record and state of legal residence,
It is by law the state the federal government expects me to return home to. It will pay for me to return home to upon the completion of my career. It's established that way upon my enlistment into the military. It's never been changed and is a part of the federal record. Many service members change their careers throughout their careers change their residency to take advantage of resident state taxes, in-state college tuition, those types of things. In 20 years of military service, like TECO, I've never changed my home of record or residency from Alaska, nor have I taken advantage of or benefited from claiming residency in any other state. I've lived in 6 states and now 1 foreign country, but I've had ties to only 1 state, and that state is Alaska. I ask you to pass House Bill 190 to allow lifetime Alaskans and career military personnel to continue to receive our PFDs. I also ask that you backdate it to the 2009 PFD so that I and others can rightfully be declared Alaskans again. I think it's the right thing to do. Thank you for listening.
And I thank you very much, sir, for your service and your testimony. I might point out to the committee that Colonel Ross has been holding on the line for 2 hours to testify before us today, and I think he said, or somebody said, it's 3 a.m. in the morning. So that's the kind of service that we need, both to the state and to our nation. With that, we are going to adjourn the committee. We'll be meeting again Tuesday. We will be considering HB 178 again on elections. We will be hearing SB 93 special license plates, and we have one person on the Governor's Department of the Board of Parole, and we'll do what we can here with the bill HB 190 we just heard. So we're getting into crunch time. Thank you for your service, and let's go cast some important votes on the House floor. We are.